morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour and at irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had another good week. For those of you who celebrate Bloomsday and all things Joyce in around this time of year, I hope you had a nice day on Tuesday last. On this week's show, I suppose, generally what one could say is that our theme is Belfast. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with the author of a fascinating new book, Vicky Kostick, who's written Belfast, Toward a City Without Walls. And it basically charts the evolution and the existence today of the walls and the peace lines some of us are so familiar with in Belfast. And in keeping with the theme, since we've heard about the recent passing there last week of the late Father Colum Campbell, I thought it would be nice to go into the archives of Irish America and share excerpts from a 2006 oral history that was undertaken here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. My colleague, Dr. Marion Casey, who is a director of the Archives of Irish America, the senior archivist and a director of the Glucksman Ireland House Oral History Project, used the opportunity of an undergraduate class, and one of our undergraduate students had the opportunity to sit in and do an interview with Father Colum back in 2006, as I mentioned. And I just thought it would be timely. We're thinking about him quite a lot here. He was very well known here in New York for decades. He was founder and president of the New York Irish Center in Long Island City and was a former director of the Irish Apostolate USA. A great man, an inspiring person in terms of his devotion to the ministry and his communities wherever he's been. And for those of you who would like to hear a little bit of his voice and to hear, I'm going to start off this week with him talking about his background and his childhood, etc. It's very, very interesting. And I'll follow up next week with some more from Father Colum Campbell's oral history. So it is a theme of Belfast this week here on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Eriashteg Reva Hanum Dilish. So enjoy hearing Vicky talk about the research she has undertaken on Belfast, and then we'll go straight in to Father Colum Campbell. I'm delighted to welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour the author of a very new book, Vicky Kostick, and the book is called Belfast, Toward a City Without Walls. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's hot off the press, isn't it?
Well, yes, you and I have got the two. I had my first copy yesterday.
And it's published by Colourpoint Books. I suppose later on we'll have a chat about how people will get their hands on a copy. So in short, what you do in this book, Vicky, is tell the story of the 100 sectarian walls and interface, which are still part of the landscape of Belfast. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into this program and maybe about your relationship with Ireland? Because You don't have an Irish accent.
No, and I'm very embarrassed about my British accent when it comes to all things Irish. But in fact, my relationship with Ireland goes back to me living in New York when I came to, my husband and I came to live in New York in 1974. And we, in fact, all the friends we made over here were Irish, either Irish or Irish and Irish American extraction. My husband was a rugby player. He joined the New York Athletic Club, and that was where the Irish tended to, Irish rugby players headed there. And I became, I had some sort of fascination with Ireland from reading Portrait of the Artist in school, but I had, like a lot of English people, I had grown up totally ignorant of Ireland, and all I knew was that Ireland was a problem. I mean, Ireland was defined as a problem, both because of the news, the troubles, but also because, you know, that was the way it was defined in your history. When you studied history, it was the Irish problem. Anyway, we met a lot of Irish people here, and I became increasingly fascinated with Ireland. And in 1977, I took a three-month trip by myself around Ireland. And I actually, it was the mother of a great Belfast friend of ours who we'd made over here, Billy Haldane. But I went into Belfast in September 77 and went to stay with Bill Haldane's mother. And I travelled from there and down to Inniskeen, Paddy Kavanagh's country, where Bernard O'Rourke's mother, I stayed with another family of a New York friend of ours, down to Dublin to his cousin, and then over to the Aran Islands, and then finally up to Donegal, where I did not know anybody. But I went to stay, I picked something out of the Bord Fáilte catalogue, which turned, they was described as a two-bedroom flat. But in fact, it was half of a farmhouse right next to St. Columbkill's Oratory in Garton in County Donegal. And I fell completely in love with Donegal, fell in love with Ireland, have been going back ever since, and now, as I say, have a house in Donegal. My first article about Belfast was actually written during that first trip, and it was published in the New York Daily News, and it was called The War Goes On, and it was a full-page article about the troubles in Belfast, and that was published in March 78. And in March 1988, when I was then living back in England, we went back in 1982, and I had a job as a journalist on a Catholic newspaper called The Tablet, very well-known Catholic newspaper. And in 1988, a priest called Father Tom Toner, who was the uncle of a very good friend of mine in Belfast, he was the parish priest at St. Agnes on the Andersonstown Road. At the time of the Gibraltar murders, the assassinations of the three IRA members in Gibraltar, Maureen Farrell, Sean Savage and Danny McCann. And Tom Toner was the priest at the funerals of Maureen Farrell and Danny McCann. And at that funeral, Michael Stone threw the grenade into the cemetery and Kevin Brady was killed. And Tom Toner was the priest at that funeral. And at that funeral, the two soldiers were killed, they were dragged out of the car. They had strayed into the funeral cortege and they were murdered in Casement Park. And Tom Toner asked me to come over and write an article about the impact on his parish of what had been going on around Gibraltar. And I did that.
Were you a freelance journalist in London?
I was assistant editor on The Tablet, so I worked full-time on The Tablet. And then I left The Tablet, but I was still writing. I still had a very strong association with The Tablet. I mean, in fact, what I went on to do was, while I was in New York, I did a master's degree in theology at Union Theological Seminary. I became a Catholic and did a master's in theology, and so I left The Tablet and went to work for the Catholic Church in London, and I worked for them for 15 years. But I was still writing, so I wrote that article. And in December 2012, Tom Toner, who by then was Monsignor Tom Toner, and he was a prominent priest in Belfast, he died, and I went to his funeral. So this was now 25 years after Gibraltar. I went to his funeral, and I reconnected with some of the people who I had interviewed for that article in 1988. And I realized that March 2013 was going to be the 25th anniversary of Gibraltar and the 15th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which was the 9th of April 1998. So I wrote an article, two articles actually, for the Tablet in March of 2013 about what was going on in West Belfast on 15 years after the Good Friday Agreement and 25 years after Gibraltar. And it was during the research for that that I discovered the extent of these walls. And I just got very curious about them, and I started asking people in Belfast, so what about these walls? And people would say, what walls? You know, or, oh, they're just there, or they're always going to be there, or, you know. And I thought, well, hold on a minute. There's more to it than that. And then the OFMDFM, First Minister Peter Robinson and Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness, made this commitment in this document, TBUC, Together Building United Community. In May 2013, they made a commitment to bring the walls down within 10 years. And at that point, I started to do the research on what had been written about the walls, and I discovered that there was no real book about them. There was quite a lot of academic stuff, PhDs, whatever, reports, but there was nothing accessible and readable. And so I got fascinated.
What's interesting about that as well, Vicky, I feel like, at least from the sense I get from US visitors and students who travel, say, to the US from here,
right,
it's one of the things they always remark about.
Walls
are part of that, you know, tourist landscape.
Absolutely.
In a way.
So I discovered that there's 1.7 million visitors to Northern Ireland every year. 25% of them go and visit the walls and the interface areas. They take a black taxi tour, or they take a bus tour, or they go on a walking tour. So you're right. And in fact, if you look at TripAdvisor and, you know, what are the most popular destinations for tourists, the walls and the black taxi rank consistently amongst the highest thing. But there's a certain amount of denial on the tourist agencies about this fascination. They're very ambivalent about it. As I say in the book, there's a huge amount of ambivalence. But if you were a tourist and you went to see those walls, I discovered if you wanted to learn more about them, there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
So that really got me going. So I did 6 months of exploratory research, really. And by December 2013, I realized that the project was a goer and that I could actually do a book. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
So tell us about the process then of, I suppose it's kind of snowball effect in terms of reaching out. And you have... You had long-standing contacts in the community, right? Is that
so? I had the contacts that I had from doing these articles on West Belfast. But as I say in the book, very quickly a sort of momentum developed. You know, it was, you know, as I say, opportunities and invitations. Something happened, and I had a lot of help from specific people. I mean, I have to give a huge amount of credit to Marcino Muglior, who I interviewed him for that original article in 2013. He became Lord Mayor in June 2013. And he's got this extraordinary network of contacts. And he kept inviting me back to shadow him as Lord Mayor. And I spent at least half a dozen days trailing around Belfast with him. And of course, everyone I met, I was able to go back to them and say, oh, we met in the Lord Mayor parlour, can I come and chat to you? Or I would say to him, I need a contact who's doing X, Y, and Z. And then extraordinary other coincidences. My next door neighbour's father in London happened to be the head of the Northern Ireland Housing Executive for 40 years, or had worked for the Housing Executive for 40 years and was their director when he retired. He gave me a huge number of contacts. And everybody I met and interviewed would say, oh, you need to go and talk to so-and-so, or you need to go and talk to so-and-so. So the research snowballed, and I found doors opened everywhere. I found, you know, there seemed to be no resistance to the fact that I was, you know, British or whatever. People were just so helpful.
So for any of our listeners who haven't actually been in Belfast. Can you contextualise or describe a little bit what's involved when we're talking about these walls?
As people may know, there was this brutal conflict in Northern Ireland from 1969 until the peace agreement in 1998. And it raged amongst Catholics, Protestants, the British Army, and basically in the Northern Irish police. I don't try and go into the causes of that in the book. But the reality is that the working class, most of the conflict played out in the working class areas of Belfast. In fact, within 10 specific, what we would call postcodes, they would call zip codes here. So within a very limited area, I think 70% of the deaths took place within very specific areas. And these are what we call the interface areas. They're the specific areas where Catholic working class areas and Protestant working class areas actually come up against each other. And Belfast is like a patchwork of these areas. And they started putting walls up in 1969 as a desperate mechanism to try and stop people killing each other. That's what the British Army did. They started putting, first of all, they would have been rolls of barbed wire, they could have been concrete posts, they could have been, and as the years went by, they put up more and more walls and they got higher and higher. And one of the strange things is that a third of the walls were put up since the peace agreement in 1998. This is what a lot of people find very difficult to get their heads around, that once there was decommissioning of weapons and once the bombs stopped, so once you had a peace agreement, the walls became the manifestation of the ongoing conflict. So people believe, or they might believe, that there has been peace since 1998, but in fact, the conflict continues and the walls are both the physical manifestation of the conflict, but also are imbued with all sorts of symbolic significance. They're imbued with layers of meaning. And they went on being built till about 2007, when responsibility for justice, and it's the Justice Department who have responsibility for the walls, it wasn't until 2009 that responsibility for justice was devolved to the Northern Ireland administration, to David Ford, who became Justice Minister and still is Justice Minister. And he personally said, we are not going to build any more walls. So the wall building stopped, although he had to cave in November 2013. This fence was put up in the grounds of St Matthew's Roman Catholic Church in the Short Strand in East Belfast. But apart from that, there's been virtually no wall building since then.
One of the things, Vicky, is that you contextualise a little bit the walls in Belfast in comparison with, you know, what we know of other famous walls, a little bit, you know, Berlin. And I suppose the other wall that I always think of is the big peace wall in Israel as well. So I know you didn't focus on like looking at other places, but, you know, on the basis of your research, are there ways in which the peace walls in Belfast are different to some of those other examples that we know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually decided not to try and go into too much comparison. So I mentioned them, but I decided to focus on the Northern Irish ones. Certainly the Berlin situation was very different because you just had the one wall, which was divided two political regimes, and I mean, it went up more or less overnight and separated communist Berlin from the Western Berlin. So it was really a different situation. And similarly, in Israel and Palestine, it's a different situation. These walls in Belfast are within a city, and there are, as I say, up to 100 different kinds of interface. They include barriers across streets, they include car parks, they include fences that run up between people's back gardens, they include the big walls that people are familiar with. but it's this patchwork in a city which is supposed to be at peace, which I quote one academic in the book who says, sectarianism thrives amongst people who are most alike. The really curious thing about Belfast is that there is no way of telling a Protestant person from a Catholic person. And one of the only ways they have is what street they've walked down. So the walls ensure that you know that if somebody comes down a particular street or through a particular gate, they're almost certainly of the other grouping because of the direction they've come from. You've got no other way of telling who they are. Mm-hmm. So in any event, so as I say, I focused very much on the Belfast walls rather than trying to draw too many comparisons.
It's such a rich example in and of itself. Could you talk a little bit, Vicky, more about, you know, the sense of how they've become part of the landscape, not only geographically or physically, but in terms of, like, how people in Belfast almost don't see them, right?
Well, this is it. So one of the things I say is that the closer you are to a wall, the more invisible they are, in the sense that the people who live around them take them so much for granted that they just don't think about them. But if you see them as an outsider, you can't help but be shocked by them. Partly because they are extremely ugly. Nearly all the walls are, and a lot of the barriers across roads are very heavy pieces of military hardware. So they're very ugly. They force people to walk miles around them if they have to get from A to B. And yet, as you say, the people who live near them take them now completely for granted. But people use metaphors about them all the time. So, for example, one person might say, the walls are our wounds. You know, so they are almost attached to them as a memorial of the conflict. So one of the most interesting things is, for me, became, why are they holding on to these walls? And as I did more and more research, I realized that there was a huge relationship between the walls and the interface areas and the very high levels of post-traumatic stress as a result of the conflict. But there seems to be a very high level of denial, both about the existence of the walls themselves and about the very high levels of post-traumatic stress.
One of the points you also make in the book, Vicky, is, and I'd like for you to chat a little bit about this, if possible, is a gap that you noticed between a sense that there could be a return to conflict or violence. You noticed a difference in the degree of stability, I think, in terms of your research through the people you were interacting with. Am I correct in terms of interpreting how you...
I did not meet anybody within Belfast who believes that the conflict will return. Sometimes people outside Belfast say that they think the conflict might return. So, in fact, Richard Haass, who, as people will be aware, came over to Northern Ireland with Megan O'Sullivan, professor at Harvard University, and they tried to facilitate peace talks. Those talks collapsed at New Year's 2014. So the talks ran through December 2013 and collapsed at New Year's. And he told Congress, I think it was in April 2014, that he feared that a return to violence was likely in Northern Ireland. But nobody I met, in fact, people said to me again and again, however bad things get, nothing will ever go back. So people don't believe that, and there's no appetite. There is absolutely no appetite for a return to serious violence. But there's a certain stuckness about the ongoing sectarian situation, the ongoing division between Protestant and Catholic, and the levels of post-traumatic stress, the continuing presence and influence of former paramilitaries who are still very influential in working class areas, and low levels of violence, particularly in these interface areas. So it's a stuckness. Mm-hmm. And because of the levels of denial, that's what's creating the stuck situation.
Am I right in assuming, Vicky, that this book, in a way, not only are you filling a kind of void or lacuna in terms of what's been written about the walls, but in a way it kind of provokes dialogue and reflection on their presence and as we look to 2023? I mean, do you think that goal is realistic of the walls being down in that time frame?
Well, in a funny sort of way, I wasn't trying to do anything with the book, and it was almost very important that I wasn't trying to do anything other than to tell a story and try and tell it well. Of course, I was very highly aware of the levels of sensitivity in these areas. There are levels of sensitivity about the fact that when there have been moves to actually remove particular barriers, or if there was news in the press, then that would set back the dialogue around removal of the walls. So I'm very aware of the levels of sensitivity, and I've gone to inordinate lengths to try and pay attention to that. At the same time, I guess that I would hope that the book will focus attention in an educated and responsible way on the fact that there is still a problem there.
So do you have a sense, it's too early to tell how Belfasters will respond to it?
No, I don't know.
Are you apprehensive?
I am apprehensive. But it's been read, of course, by a number. I had a lot of very helpful criticism, including from a Belfast journalist who read all the drafts of the book and gave me some trenchant feedback, which was very helpful. But yes, I'm apprehensive.
I think that's always for any scholarly work where we're writing on any community.
Absolutely.
It's always the ultimate test for us, isn't it? But I have a feeling that people will be very happy with it. Congratulations. It's a great read. I would highly encourage people who are interested in the history of Belfast and what's going on in Belfast now, and a different perspective on the city through the voice of the walls to some extent, or from the perspective of the walls. It's Belfast Toward a City Without Walls by Vicky Kostick. It's published by Colourpoint.
There's a US publisher as well.
Oh, very good.
Casement. So it will be available on Amazon or whatever directly.
Here in the US.
Yeah. It's been published here as well.
Very good. Congratulations, Vicky. Job well done. And thank you for coming in to chat to us here at Luxembourg Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. And welcome to Luxembourg Ireland House. I know it's your first visit here to us. Hopefully we'll be back again talking to you at some point soon.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you.
Today is November 13th, 2006. My name is Diego Carvajal, and I'm interviewing Father Colman Campbell.
Yes.
How you doing, nice Father?
Very well. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Could you tell us your year and place of birth?
My year was 1935, June the 11th, and Belfast, Northern Ireland was my place of birth.
What part of the city is that?
New Lodge on the corner of the Antrim Road.
Could you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
My childhood, we lived there, I'm told, I don't remember this, until I was 4 years of age, and there were trams on the Antrim Road at that time. And a couple of times I managed to escape from my parents and was almost running across the Antrim Road. So they moved then further up the Cliftonville Road, which is a road off it, and we lived there until 1969. When my parents had to get out of there because of the police came and literally took them out because they were under threat. My father had been the Catholic on the Cameron Commission that did away with the B specials, so they had to be moved out very quickly. But we were there from 37 to 69.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your parents?
My parents, my father was fairly well known. He was J.J. Campbell. He was quite unique in his time. Give you a bit of a story which coloured his life. He was they lived on the New Lodge Road. He was very fond as a kid of a barman who worked in the bar across the street. And this barman, every time his conversation was, "You stay at school, you stay with the books, and you get on," because my grandfather abhorred books. He owned 5 shops, and school and learning was a waste of time. He couldn't write his name. I have his marriage certificate with his mark on it, you know. So this barman was very friendly with my father. He encouraged him to go against this, and my granny also encouraged him and hid him under the table at times to read. So one day he's looking out the window and he sees a policeman going into the bar and actually shooting this barman friend of his. He was 10-year-old at the time. And the family had to give up everything and go to Scotland, because if it was known that he had seen it and it was going to get out, you know, the police would have shot him eventually, you know. So they were in Scotland for 2 or 3 years, and then he came back. And my grandfather at that stage was broken. He had lost all his businesses and he was a broken man after that. So my father was still at secondary school at St. Malachy's. He got a scholarship there from the primary, and he was there for a year, and my grandmother decided she had to take him out because there was no income coming into the family. So Monsignor Hendley of the president of the college came to see her and said, you know, he wanted him to stay, and he wouldn't charge any fees. So he got staying there, and then he did very well. He got a Peel scholarship, which was only 2 in existence each year, to Queen's University. And he got a first class honours degree in classics, which he taught for quite a while. And was a sort of very he was one of the first Catholics, certainly of his generation, to get any kind of a major education. Certainly the only Catholics who did were, the joke used to be, they were policemen's children or barmen's children or bar owners' children. And he became very prominent in the Catholic community. And I remember the bishop in 1934 asked him to write about what was going on at the time and the way Catholics were being persecuted and weren't getting jobs. My father got a first class honours degree. Another guy in the same class got a second upper. When the professorship came vacant, of course, it wasn't my father got it. So he wrote a famous book which was called Orange Terror, which basically listed all the things that were going on, the way that people were kept out of jobs, statements that politicians had made and so on. It caused an uproar, and we had to clear out to Dublin. It wasn't known exactly who wrote it, but there was obviously suspicion. And we cleared out to Dublin, and we were there for about 3 or 4 months. I think what saved them was a number of very prominent people, including the bishop, you know, backed it and said it was all true, so it was very hard for them to do anything to us, you know. So that was his beginning. I suppose he also spoke fluent Irish, and he played the fiddle, and he played in the band in the what was called the Art School, which was an Irish sort of community centre where they had dances and Irish classes and so on. That's where he met my mother. She was a secretary working for a Jewish firm. So there were 6 of us. I was the oldest. My brother next to me, Seamus, he became a cancer specialist and went to Australia. Kevin became the psychologist for the Northeastern Education and Library Board. Josephine, my sister, was a teacher, and then she went out with her husband for 6 years to Africa, teaching out there in a Jesuit school as a missionary. Next to her was Sean, who became a priest and has since died. And my youngest brother, then, Brenton, he's a retired teacher in England.
So there was an emphasis on education?
I suppose there was. Oh, yes, definitely, yeah.
Was that coming from both your mother and father? Or
My father would have been much more. But I think my mother would have been very much supportive of it. I mean, she was the one who carried out the practicalities. You sit down there and do your homework, you know. That sort of thing, so.
Could you tell us a little bit about your own education?
My own education, I was at a primary, parish primary school, Holy Family, on the Antrim Road, just up from New Lodge. I was there for a year, and then there was the Blitz in Belfast, which I can remember vividly. I was, that was 42, or four, and I was, remember the house, all the windows blowing in, and having to be taken out of it. And a great friend of my father's, Paddy Gregory, an architect, he had was allowed a car for some reason, and he came and picked us all up and took us down to Arglass, where we lived for 2 years until the sort of the fear of another raid was over. Father travelled every day up and down to school, so I was educated then for 2 years in the primary school in Arglass, a little fishing village about 28 miles from Belfast in County Down. And then back to Holy Family again. From there I did what was called the 11 plus. It was a system introduced in Ireland where when you reached 11 years they decided what kind of future education was best for you. And the theory of it, I don't think it would be very much contradicted I think today, but the idea was, had you an academic bent or had you a more practical bent? And but it became really pass and fail. You know, you passed it, you got into the grammar type, academic type of school where you did languages and so on. If you didn't, you went to some of the intermediate schools where the emphasis was much more on doing woodwork and those kind of, you know, cookery, and the girls did an awful lot of homemaking and stuff like that. So I was at St. Malachy's then. I did junior certificate there after 2 years and senior certificate after two more. So I must have started there 35, 46, 47. I went to St. Malachy's, and 53, I left there to go to Queen's University. And I did a degree that included mathematics and Latin, which we had to do, and Greek, and history, Irish history.
How unusual was it in 52-3 for Catholics to be at Queen's?
Not too unusual.
Better than in your father's day.
Oh, absolutely. What made the big difference was this 11 plus thing. They brought in England general education for everybody with the Labour government after the war, and they more or less brought the same thing in Northern Ireland. So I was the first generation of Catholics who got a free education if you had the ability. I mean, the ones that followed me, like Bernadette Devlin and all those famous people, you know, they got their education through that system. Which was, you know, a big, big change. It was a free education, well, based on a means test, but it was free. So, and I, at that stage, I also decided to become a priest. And I was 4 years in, 3 years in Queen's. The first year I wasn't in the seminary. The second year I was, and we went out to Queen's from the seminary, which was part again of St. Malachy's College, but not the grammar school part. And then we did philosophy also in Queen's. We had to do that. Then I got the BA and then went to Maynooth for 4 years. In 56, was ordained 1960. My first appointment was as chaplain to the Good Shepherd Convent, which was a great starting off experience, I suppose, although I mightn't have appreciated it at the time. The convent had a number of sections, and it was very strange during Mass. there were partitions for the length of the church. No one group and between these partitions could see each other, but I could see them all from the altar, at least halfway down some of them from the altar. And on the extreme right were the single mothers. Then there was what was called the girls, even though the girls were in age from 17 to 90 and more. And in the middle was the nuns. And then on the other side of the nuns was another group of nuns. And they were beautiful people. They were people who had been in trouble one way or another and decided they had a vocation, and they became Carmelites. And they were the most beautiful, innocent, charming, genuine people I ever met. They were lovely people. And the foundress of that Good Shepherd Order, she had fought the Pope quite literally, had a huge arguments with him. And they eventually agreed that they could become nuns, but they couldn't become nuns with other nuns, and they had to be separate. And they couldn't have their own superior, it'd have to be a Good Shepherd nun, and so on. So,
Where was that?
That was in Belfast.
So you were ordained for Belfast?
I was ordained for Down and Connor Diocese, which includes Belfast. Belfast and most of County Antrim and some of County Down.
And so where in Belfast was the convent?
On the Armour Road, 511 Armour Road, I remember. It was at what was known as Pope's Corner, because right at that corner was the Good Shepherd Convent, and across the street was the Nazareth House Convent. And across the street from that was Nazareth House Home for Boys. And round the corner was Nazareth House Home for Girls. Of course, they didn't mix, even though they were brother and sister. They weren't allowed to see each other very often. So that's where I was stationed. And beyond, as I say, there was those nuns. And then the final section was what was known as the children. And they were from, you know, any age, 4 or 5 anyway, up to about 15, 16, 17. They were all committed to the care of the nuns because of the needing care and protection for whatever reason from home. A lot of criticism, and there was a laundry, by the way, and the girls from they mentioned the age 17 to 90, they worked in the laundry. Now, in fairness, the laundry was a good idea because it provided all kinds of work for all kinds of skills, from very basic, you know, scrubbing and cleaning, and to operating very complicated machines, to bookkeeping, to, you know, taking orders from people, wrapping stuff, meeting people. And they made hosts and things. And it was very much a little village on its own. The whole thinking of the place was that the world of the 60s did not accept a girl if she got into any kind of trouble, whether it was before the courts for stealing or any kind of crime, or if she'd had a baby. It was awful, really, when you look back on it. But it was always a very painful experience because the mother in the north of Ireland has no right to find the child. The child has every right to find her. And I mean, there's all kinds of dilemmas when they came to get married. Would they tell the new boyfriend what happened, or would they not? And I mean, in those days, 9 times out of 10, they would have been rejected. You know, so it was a, God love them. I mean, there's nobody suffered like them. I've never met a group that suffered as much, really, as they did, because they were just good people. And because of that, they were suffering, you know. So that was there. And then the children, when they left, very often they got sent into domestic, or else they went back home into the same situation for which, you know, but they'd reached 18 and were no longer a ward of court or whatever. So I founded a youth club. I got an old house somebody gave me, and it was basically a place where I could meet them, because I found trying to keep in touch with them all was just impossible, and it was just a work that was growing and growing and growing. So I founded this with a lot of opposition at the start from the nuns, and then with their full support, and they provided premises in the convent for it. But it certainly, for me, was a big part of the work, because it meant that whatever good they'd got from the convent life, they, there was a chance to keep in touch with them and save them from being victims of this, of the culture and the circumstances that they, that they had grown up in initially, you know.
They would have stayed in the school till, or in the convent till what, 10, 11?
Depending how long, if the family situation improved, they would have been left. They would have stayed till they were 18, and if they would have been moved somewhere around 11 or 12. They went out to the school up to 15 in the local school, and then they were there after that. They would have gone over to the laundry side.
So your age group that you founded the youth group for, the youth, what did you call it?
I just called it the youth club.
The youth club.
Yeah.
What age group were you?
That was mainly for the 14 up, yeah, the 15, 16, 17, 18. And many of the others would have helped out in it. And then there were the group who were in the convent for life. Because when they came in, maybe, 1920s and 30s, some of them, the whole idea was that the world had rejected them, and it really had rejected them, parents and everybody. They were disgraced to the family, they were sinners. So the idea of the nuns was they came in, they give them in a different name. So as you're starting a new life, but you become part of this little village. It was very self-contained. There was work, there was prayer, too much prayer probably, I would think. But drama groups would have brought plays in. They had film pretty often. The Mulholland School, which started the whole idea, like of Riverdance, where she did all the Irish mythic tales, about Cahullin and that. She did them all in dance form. They used to come in and out. So there was regular, it was really a fairly complete village sort of life, but great discouragement about going out. And they were institutionalized and weren't ready to go out. Eventually what happened was the nuns built little homes in the convent grounds for three or four of them together. And that's where any of the rest are now. They're sort of running their own little house with the help of nuns if they need it, you know.
And they're the last of their generation.
They're the last of their generation, absolutely, yeah.
Just trying to set things back a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about your initial decision to get into
become a priest?
Yeah.
It was a very strange thing. There was a priest who was the spiritual director in St. Malachy's called Charlie Agnew. He was known as Wee Charlie. And he was famous for grabbing people, when they were walking past and coming over and bringing into a corner and saying, I think you should be a priest. And this was a sort of a joke around the class, you know. So I had made up my mind, if he came to me, I was telling him to get off and leave me alone. I was not even to think about it. And I did meet him and I did tell him that. And I felt guilty afterwards. And I suppose that sort of planted the seed, and I began to ask why, and why did you say no, and why not, and so that went on for a couple of years. So about the age of 17, I decided, well, I'll give it a try. That was the year, I think it was just about finishing in grammar school and about to go to university. So I did give it a try, and I did the philosophy and the BA for through the seminary, through Queen's, living there, and then went to Maynooth in 1956. And I remember recently, about 20 years ago, a psychologist saying you can make a decision from about 12, 13, 14, but you can't make a decision for life because you really don't know what it means till you're 22. Well, I thought I had made the decision to be a priest. And when he said that, it hit me like a bomb, because I had no bother till going back Christmas of my second year in Maynooth, when I was just about 22. And it was, you went back at Christmas in the awful weather, you went through that stone wall gate, and you knew you weren't getting out of there to the end of June, no matter what, you know. So I was really down, I spent 7 or 8 totally sleepless nights. Will I stay or will I not?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point where I made up my mind.
Can you remember
what
in that 7 nights? What was the turning point?
It was just, will I or won't I? Am I good enough? Could I make this? Can I cope with it? And an awful lot of praying and an awful lot of uncertainty.
Was your mother happy about your decision to go into the seminary?
I never knew that. She seemed at the start, but I remember one Christmas when she was sort of, she wasn't drunk, but she was, she'd had a few, and she, as it, when I was about third year in Maynooth, year after that, and she said, "Are you sure you want to go on?" And she was just wanting to be. It shook me at the time. I thought you were being supportive of this idea, but maybe she was beginning to feel she didn't want to be seeming to push me, you know.
What about your father?
He was very pleased. Actually, I think he was thinking very much of that, and I have a suspicion that Monsignor Henley kept him in St. Malachy's because that would have been his hope, you know, but it wasn't the way it turned out. So,
you're saying that your father might have been a priest?
It might have been expected of him, you know.
So.
And I mean, he would have probably been one of the leading, because he was reckoned as one of the best to ever go through St. Malachy's, you know.
What order of priest is St. Malachy's?
No, it's the Diocesan Seminary, yeah.
And did your brother, I think you said Sean, was a priest?
He was, yeah.
And was St. Olaf of the Diocese?
He was, yeah. Though he went to Carlow Seminary. And he went there for the whole 6 years. Yeah.
And how did they make the decision between Maynooth and Carlow?
I think certainly in Bishop McGain's time, which was mine, there were no exceptions, except there were huge reasons, you know. Everybody had to go to Maynooth, everybody had to get a university degree, or you were just not accepted. I think it was beginning to, with the changes coming about around about, you know, Vatican II and that, there was a feeling that why a degree for a priest, you know. I mean, there could be very good priests who maybe wouldn't have that academic level. So I think, depending on your results in the senior certificate, probably was what made the decision.
And did he serve in Belfast too?
He did serve for 10 years and then he left. And he got married. He has two beautiful, wonderful teenage children now. He died at 55 of prostate cancer, which my father had died of. And my uncle had died of sort of a family disease, you know. That's basically the convent anyway, I think.
What year did you leave there? The Good Shepherd?
67 I left there. I went from there to be chaplain in a little country parish, little country town of Crumlin. It was right beside the airport. In fact, the little church was built in what had been an alder grove, and the church was called Alder Grove. And they opened a railway station when they built the railway line. It was one of the oldest churches, and when they built the railway line, they built a halt at Alder Grove Church, and the halt at the railway line was called Alder Grove. And then when they built the airport in 1917, in the First World War, for the newly formed RAF or whatever they called it then, the steam engines that dragged all the equipment from the railway up to make the airport came from the airport Alder Grove station. So the airport got named Alder Grove, which was a strange mix, you know, because there was no town land or any other reason beyond the fact that the church was in a little grove of alder trees. And I was there for 6 years, and I was also had to be chaplain to the British Army, which was based there for the Troubles. and the RAF, yeah.
On whose orders? The bishop?
Well, the bishop, yeah. There was that arrangement. But had been always there that the curate at that end of the parish was also the chaplain to the Air Force. And therefore he became the chaplain when the army moved into the barracks and so on for the time of the Troubles.
That was an interesting place to be.
It was very interesting because I was able to get a lot of, I met a lot of the top people, and I was able to get the Catholic viewpoint over to them very often, which wasn't very often understood, you know. They sort of got some kind of weird textbook idea about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Catholics were IRA and all that sort of thing, you know. So I was 6 years there, and there was a huge amount of parish work, and it was a lovely place. It was right on the edge also of Loch Ney, and there was people there had a boatyard, and I used to love going down and I would borrow a boat, and you go out in Loch Ney, a lot of the time it was just like glass, you know, and it was just so peaceful. And I went out often to Ram's Island, which still has a complete round tower on it. And I mean, to me there's just a sense of prayer there of God. I mean, it's eerie but beautiful and wonderful, and I just find such peace in that place. It was just lovely to go there. It was a retreat every time to go out to it. And I ended up then getting an old school for the diocesan youth service, which was right at the side of it. And you know, the local fishermen used to take the people out on the boat, and they would, you know, have retreats out there and so on. And I had the privilege of saying mass beside that round tower, and it was the first time in 1,000 years that there had been a mass there. The island was owned by the O'Neills, who tore down the monastery which was standing and made a hunting lodge out of it. They did leave the original round tower intact, all right. So it was just a beautiful experience to be part of that. So that was one of the benefits of being in Aldergrove, and it's still a very fresh memory for me, you know.
Coming towards the end of the programme, I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Duxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE and on HD Radio in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. Our theme music today is Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannelly Show, up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend, folks. Slán agus beannacht.